Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we record the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, October 2nd, 2019, is Iris Wilcox. Thank you for joining us, Iris.
Oh, I'm glad to join you.
Before we begin, could you please provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career?
Oh my goodness, it was so long ago. But I was in Washington, D.C., and I was working there, and I got a call from an old boss who knew Governor Casey. And he said, they need some press people in this new administration. Would you be interested? I'd like to submit your resume. That's how it all started. It was really out of the blue, and I was surprised and thrilled at the same time because I was doing something outside of my area of study, and I was excited to come back. So I must say, first I interviewed with the insurance department, and that didn't work out, but then I got a call and said, hey, would you be interested in talking to the folks at Corrections? And I said, sure. I didn't really mean it. Honestly, I had no experience with Corrections at all, ever. The only thing I remembered is in junior high school, we went to visit the local lockup, and I had nightmares. I couldn't sleep that night because I remember this big door with this little window, and an inmate was peering out. It completely freaked me out. So anyway, I said, okay, I'll go, because I really was looking to change careers. So I drove from Washington into Camp Hill, where the office was, and I saw guys working in the yard, and I thought, oh my God, these must be inmates. And it's like, am I safe? That was my first thought to myself. But I went in, and I interviewed with Ken Robinson, and he described for me what at that time was a dream job for me. I just wish it had been somewhere other than Corrections at that time. Right. So anyway, I had a couple of interviews, and finally interviewed with the commissioner, who was David Owens at that time, and he was the first African-American to head that department. So I interviewed with him, and not long after, Ken offered me the job, and of course I accepted, and went into really what was the time of my life. I absolutely loved my time at the Department of Correction. The work was so gratifying and just cool to do. I remember doing a newsletter, taking pictures, and what was the coolest thing about it was, and Ken really, this is kind of how he sold the job to me. He said, we're building all these new prisons, and we're going to be doing, media tours. And so my first experience going into a state correctional facility was the commissioners here, all of these reporters, TV cameras, all of this, and we all go in this group, and it was like just cool, really cool. So it was just great. So that's kind of how I got there, and I came just at a really, really good time. There was just some exciting things happening. The idea of locking people up, that's a whole nother part. I'm not always excited about that. I really think there's room for reform in our criminal justice system. But we were at a place to try and make the very best of the situation we had, and I got to be a part of that. So that's how I kind of got in there.
Excellent. Okay, so what year was that?
Well, you said the riot was in 89. I thought it was in 88, but I think I came in 87.
Okay. All right, good. So you were there for about 2 years, and then let me lead you right into the riot. It's around 2:33 p.m. on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989. Where are you and what's happening?
Oh, my goodness. I am in my office that has a window looking into the prison yard. I see the inmates gathered together there, and I know something's wrong. and then I actually see that an officer is being beaten. I immediately go over to the commissioner's office. He has no idea what's going on. I said, Commissioner, something's going on in the yard. You need to come and see. So then the two of us, instead of walking to my office, we walked to Deputy Commissioner Erskine DeRamus's office, and we look out the window, and he sees what's going on. He picks up the phone, and he calls the superintendent there, and he says, Superintendent, what's going on in your yard? I remember it like it was yesterday. And the superintendent doesn't know. And, well, I mean, he's far from it, and you wouldn't expect that he would know. This is all happening right in the minute. And I remember that he said these words. He said, there's an officer down. Confirm. This is happening. Confirm. This is happening. Confirm. You need to get your officers, you know, to check this out. And then he hangs up and immediately sets up this war room, basically, calls all of his key guys, people. And, you know, I watched all of that, but I remember it like it was yesterday because I was the one who told the commissioner there's a problem.
Wow. Wow. So that started around 3 p.m., and it went on for that evening, into the evening, probably into the early morning hours of the next day, Thursday. But tell me, what were you experiencing at night? Like, what could you see? What was happening?
Oh, my goodness. Well, let me tell you, after I told the commissioner, I remember going back to my office for a few minutes, and my first thought was, I got to get out of here. That was my gut reaction. I opened my drawer, I reached for my car keys that were there, and then I had this thought, if I go out there and they're out there, they're going to take my car and kidnap me, I'll be a hostage, so I better stay. And that was my gut reaction was, sleep. And so I didn't, and I saw the war room set up and all of that. There really wasn't a need for me there, and I don't remember if Ken asked me or if I just went. I went back to the press office where I had worked, and I was, you know, out of there. But they were getting so many calls that I was there, and I started taking calls from the media. And, of course, there was nothing really we could tell them. You know, yes, there's a situation. We'll have a statement for you as soon as we can. But what I remember from that is as the day went on, I picked up a call, and it was from the BBC. And so I thought, oh, no, this is going not only national, it's going international. So when I finished with that, I remember I called my parents because I said, you may hear something about what's going on here, and I just want you to know that I'm safe, and I'll let you know more, you know, when I know more, but there's a riot here, and it's not good.
You know, I did the same thing. I called my mom, and I said, hey, I can't talk. Something's going on, but I'm okay. You're right. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And my parents were in Indiana, so they were miles away, but this thing was getting big. Quick, the word was out. And so I remember being there probably 36 hours that first night. Mm. It was nuts. I mean, we were on the phone. I was watching out the window, and it's a helpless feeling. Mm. It just felt, you know, what is going on, and how is this going to stop? And I remember seeing, probably wasn't until the next morning, but when it was light, you would see white sheets, you know, out the window where inmates said, we're holed up in cells saying, help us. Because, you know, in these kind of situations, the weak inmates, they get brutalized in some of these things. Thankfully, as I recall, there were no deaths, but there were some people that were badly injured. All this, your snitches, as they're called, those folks, many of the inmates go after them first. So there was just so much going on. I remember going home that next morning just absolutely exhausted. Actually, it was later in the day. I went home and I was absolutely exhausted. And I remember laying on my sofa. I didn't go to bed, but I laid on the sofa, and I had the TV on. Mm-hmm. And I remember I woke up, and I heard, you know, Camp Hill is burning. Well, I said to myself in my dazed state and sleep deprived, I said, oh, they're showing this from last night. And then I kept watching, and it was like Oh, no, because they put it down fairly quickly, you know, the first time it happened, but it immediately kind of went back up, and so I remember I jumped up, I got in my car, and I went right back to work.
And tell me what that was like when you were driving back. What could you see? Where did you park? What were you seeing, like, outside of central office as you arrived?
Well, first of all, there was a barricade. You could not get, it was way down the road. You couldn't even go down the road where the prison was or the central office was. It was blocked off, and so I had to show my ID to go through that barricade. So then I drove down. I couldn't see that much, but there were state police around, as I recall, obviously, I mean, the body state police. And it was just a really somber, kind of surreal thing, almost kind of like in the movies. It's like, what is going on? This is just a really, this is trouble. This is a real problem. But I remember I got in, and I believe there was security at the front door, but of course I was able to show them my ID, and I may have even known the guys, I don't know, but I was able to go back up. And I remember Ken was still there, and, you know, taking more calls. It was tough. And I don't know if you were talking about this now, but I remember I actually saw an officer being beaten, and in hindsight, I suffered some PTSD from that.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you this now. My sister, because they knew what was going on, she lived in Philadelphia, she and her husband, and they came really to see about me. And it was a Sunday. And I remember she was fixing, like, macaroni and cheese for dinner, along with some other things. But I had the stuff. But I remember I bought some Velveeta. And if you know Velveeta, I think Velveeta can be expensive. At least I obviously thought it then. Well, when she made when she made the macaroni, you know how it swelled up? But she didn't realize the water was still in there. So she put the cheese in with the water, the part that, you know, so it was real watery. So she had to use all the Velveeta to make it right. And when she told me that, I went to the bathroom and cried. I was having a problem.
Well, I remember after the riots, just being like in a daze. Mm-hmm. It was just, you were so exhausted and just couldn't believe what had happened and what was going on. But wow, yeah, interesting. So the second night has started. You're hanging out back in the press office again, helping with all the calls. I think I remember we got, in a matter of like 3 days, over 3,000 phone calls from reporters, and over and over and over. Like, they just kept calling, and I remember Ken saying to me, just take messages and tell them we will return the calls in the order in which they came in. And I remember that they were getting frustrated because we weren't able to get back to them with really any information because, you know, things are developing. It was moving pretty quickly.
And the inmates were watching TV.
Yes. So what do you remember about that? There was some sort of issue where people on the news, because they preempted the TV, they were showing the diagram of the institution. Do you remember that?
Just vaguely. That doesn't surprise me. One of the things I do remember about this, though, is they were saying, we want to hear from the leaders. And so the question was, well, who are the leaders? We need to find out who the leaders are. And I remember Commissioner Allen said, no, we don't need to find out who the leaders are. We need to tell them who the leaders are. We're going to choose them. Of course, choose to our advantage. And so I don't recall whether they actually spoke to the media or not, but I remember that part of it. I'm not sure how the media, it may have been that they just chose the leaders that they wanted to negotiate with, that they knew were perhaps a little more cool-headed, had a little more common sense to help things calm down. But yeah, no, I remember the helicopters were flying over. We would hear the helicopters. It was constant. And it wasn't, I think it wasn't just the news. I think state police helicopters were flying over. It was just, like I said, it was like in the movies. It just was an unreal kind of experience.
Yeah, those were the state police helicopters. We had an FAA overflight restriction, so the news media couldn't fly over because the state police were constantly circling above the facility. But you're right, that sound.
Did Juan get through, though?
I don't remember that. I do remember afterwards, though, a hot air balloon flew over the institution, and that was very sneaky because, you know, they can only go where the wind takes them. So I don't think that they were actually affected by the FAA overflight restriction. I thought, oh, that's very tricky.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank goodness we weren't in the day of drones.
I'm telling you. So tell me how you remember the end of the second riot.
It was very cool. It was really cool. And I was, I don't remember who else, I think the press secretary, or the person who had replaced me was there. And we were watching together. And I remember that all the inmates were out of the yard, and the state police marched in lockstep. I mean, it was the coolest thing. And it was like, we're here to take it back.
Mm-hmm.
We're here to take it back. They marched in, and they took it back. I couldn't see inside, but they were just, it was over at that point. And, you know, I thought about it. I used to teach the new employee, new correction officers class, history classes.
Right.
And so one of the questions I would ask them is, what did I ask? Why are officers able to keep the prison under control? And the answer was because the inmates allowed them to do that. And so it, you know, everybody was kind of shaking their head. It's like by sheer numbers, the inmates have to allow it. But here's the thing: if they get out of hand, and if they try to take it over, they can, but there will be severe consequences, and we will get it back. But the reality is to try to have an atmosphere where there's cooperation with the inmates, and we talked about the importance of treating them with dignity and the fact that they're not, they're in jail as punishment, not in jail to be punished.
Right.
They're to be treated with dignity, and, you know, humanity. Their humanity is to be respected while they're there. They make bad decisions. And the reality is everybody in prison didn't do what they're charged with. So, you know, but you don't know who that is because the joke is everybody in prison is innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that's not true, but there are some innocent people in prison, and that's unfortunate. So you treat them all with dignity. You let them serve their time, hopefully, and then they go out to be productive citizens when it's over.
Right, and we know, too, that while there were about 2,000 or so inmates there at the time, really only about a couple hundred of them were actually actively rioting. The rest were trying to distance themselves from the whole thing and had kind of isolated themselves either to their cells or out to the yard. So not everybody was involved.
Not at all. Not at all. I remember one inmate, though, who was a lifer, and he had privileges, like he cooked for us, the staff, and you know, he had some privileges because he was a nice guy. He had gotten caught up because according to him, some friends robbed a bank, and I believe somebody was killed. He was always in the car, and he didn't really know what they were doing. But, of course, he was charged and convicted as an accomplice to that and got a life sentence. So it doesn't mean he was innocent. Here's the point. He had a decent life in prison. And this is what they tell you, that the lifers are your most stable population because they know they're not going anywhere, and so they want to make things as pleasant as can be where they are. But anyway, he got caught up in that somehow, and I don't know how. And so I'm not sure what happened afterwards to him, but I felt really badly about it. But he's one. Some of the inmates, it's my impression, they kind of got swept into it, whether they really wanted to do it or not, and he was one of those, I believe. Of course, you know, David Owens was a good friend, and I left with a lot of disappointment about how it was handled and how he was, they wanted him more involved at Camp Hill, and they didn't seem to give any real credence to the fact that when Camp Hill went into riots, there were rumors of riots in several of the other institutions, Greater Ford being one of the main ones. And so he was trying to keep a lid on the whole system, and for him to get involved more at Camp Hill, when it already had a superintendent with an emergency plan that was supposed to be able to do that, I think the whole thing could have blown up. But anyway,
you're right, though. I did interview somebody from Huntington, like just several days before Huntington, or before Camp Hill. Huntington had a pretty bad situation with one of their cell blocks, but it was handled quickly and brought to control. But they
that superintendent was really in charge. I can't think of his name, but I can see him. He reminded me of Santa Claus a little bit.
It was Tom Fulkemer.
Oh, yeah,
and so you're right, though. There were a lot of, we were overcrowded. Our system was overcrowded, and just the secretary or the commissioner has to run all of the facilities, not just one. And I think that our being central office being positioned right there on the grounds of the Camp Hill prison, you know, people expected us to, or him, to jump in and kind of take over the situation. But that's not how the correction system is set up. You know, that's why you have superintendents.
Emergency plan.
Because
they know he took the job with someone. I won't say who, but someone said to him, "You understand that under your watch, there will probably be a major riot." He knew that going in.
Wow.
Oh yeah. So I mean, the courage that it took to do it, but he had, you know, he had the experience. But you know, there, when these kind of things happen. And I can't even imagine, I don't know what the number is in terms of what it costs the state for all of this with the lawsuits and everything else that happened. But when you go into something, you know, like this, it's always a scapegoat, always.
Right.
And of course, the higher you go, they're not taking responsibility. It can't fall on them, so they've got to find somebody for it to fall on. And in my view, it unfairly fell in some ways, not completely, because the superintendent was fired and a bunch of folks, you know, were accused. But, you know, I just thought that he shouldn't have lost his job over that. And again, they didn't have to fire him, but of course they forced him to resign. It's technicality, semantics.
Right.
He lost his job. So, anyway, there's no good really that comes out of it. There just isn't. Because he came in when they were building so many more facilities to try to help the problem. But you can't, it's like that's the back end of it. That's not where you solve the problem. You solve it in the street. Okay, this may be a little political. I don't know. It's kind of where I am. But we were at a time where you're locking up people for, you know, a bag of marijuana, and they're getting sentences because maybe it's their third strike. But now you've got but so many of them, you know, were addicted. But now you have the opioid crisis, and it's like, don't lock them up. This is a health crisis. Well, that was too.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but when we do the right thing and give the people the kind of help they want, then that lifts some of the pressure on the prison system. Because it's not prison they need, it's help.
Exactly. People, what's driving a lot of the criminal behavior is their addiction or substance use disorder, and we need to treat them rather than incarcerate them for those things.
We do. Because and the real problem is you incarcerate them, and it's not much of a secret that people still get drugs in jail.
Mm.
So the problem's not help. They keep them in. The commissioner used to say, these are not choir boys. You bring people into prison, you put them with these guys who are not choir boys. They stay for a while, they go back out, and you expect them to be choir boys. No, they know how to better commit their crimes, how to better do their stuff without getting caught, if they can. And then, you know, many of them get caught and they go right back. So something ought to tell us the system is not working, and what do we do? But it's outside of the prison system where the help is needed, the reform is needed, so that you're not, you're only putting your really bad guy, you're only locking up your really bad guy.
Exactly. And they do have something that they're doing here called the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, where it is using things like diversionary courts to provide people with treatment, whether it's mental health or veterans courts or substance use courts, so that those people don't enter the prison system. Instead, they get the treatment they need, they stay out in their community, and then we'll hope to see a reduction in the prison population, which will bring down our spending, and then we can reinvest some of that money that would have gone to our system back into the community to continue the cycle of treatment versus incarceration.
I love it. I love it. It's just, you know what, the reality, it really is just common sense. But when you mix politics in it and people, you know, taking stands, grandstanding, and doing things for their own political gain, you get just, and working on people's emotions. You know, it's wrong.
Yeah,
in my opinion, it's wrong.
I think we're seeing a huge shift in criminal justice, prison, prison reform right now. So, I think we're moving in the right direction. It's just taken us way too long to get here.
Oh my, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, to be, as civilized as we call ourselves, to be as rich as we are as a country, and then to have the largest prison population, something is very, very wrong.
Yep. And I don't know if you know, we have Secretary Wetzel now, and he's really big into doing the right thing and prison reform. And so he's been here for two governors now, and I think, you know, we're definitely moving towards the right direction. It's just, unfortunately, Pennsylvania's a little slow in moving in the right direction, but we're getting there.
Well, what I'm so happy, I didn't know, I haven't followed it, I'm sort of pretty removed from all of that, but what I love about what you just said is you have a commissioner who's been there over two governors. Now, I don't know if it's two governors of the same party.
No, different parties.
See? That makes so much sense to me. Mm-hmm. Take the politics out. Leave the person who is effective and able to do the job in there.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Because it takes longer than a governor's administration, in some cases 4 years to even 8 years, to implement the changes that you need to implement.
Absolutely. Well, how about just to understand really what's going on?
Mm. Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
And to gain the respect of your staff and your officers, your superintendents, so that they know, because what happens so often, and I've seen this, gosh, so many places, it's like, oh, we're going to do it, we're just waiting them out.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be gone, I'll still be here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really have to do what they say. It has to look like I'm doing what they say, but they're going to be gone long before me. And that cripples the person. It takes away a lot of leverage. It makes them, unable to do some things. Because we know these jails, these prisons are small societies in and of themselves. They have their own political hierarchy and all this stuff, from the prisoners to the staff. And so you've got all that working. And somebody outside who's over it, but is really outside and temporary, there's only so much impact that they can make.
Exactly. Wow, we've really covered a lot. Is there anything else from the riot that you recall that you'd like to share?
Well, this comes to mind. After I had been there for the 2 days and I was going home, I was so, so, so exhausted, and I didn't think I could make it home. It was so bad that on the way, I was screaming, just to keep myself awake. And I mean, I was kind of nodding in the car. And it's like, how am I going to, I didn't think I was going to make it home, because I was ready just to black out at any moment. It was terrible. It's just the toll it takes. And it's not just the physical toll and the lack of sleep, it's the emotional toll that it takes. It took a huge emotional thing. I have it in my life. I don't know that I've seen more than one person, in real fight, where people are really getting beaten and I don't know if they're going to live or die. you just don't, that's not everyday life, not, at least not in my world.
Right.
And so it took quite a toll. And I remember that I was doing a workshop with another woman on the Saturday, that Saturday after the riots. And I think I'd come home, I believe it was on a Friday, when it all ended. And I'd gone to bed, and I remember, well, I've got this session in the morning, this workshop, something on PR or whatever. And I was prepared for the workshop, but the lady called me and to say, you know, don't worry about it. I know what you've been through. I'll do it. Well, I woke up that morning. So she called me. I talked to her. I woke up that morning, and I started getting ready for the chaplain. And I called her, and I said, I just want you to know that I'm coming. She said, well, I talked to you last night. I told you I would do it. I had no recollection of talking to anybody. I had no idea.
Oh.
I talked to her. That's how out of it I was. But I went ahead and did it, and it was fine because I got to talk a little bit about what I'd been through, too, over those days. So that was good, but it took a toll. It really took a toll on me, and I had no idea. And, you know, after, well, Commissioner left, Ken left, I don't remember who else, and they started changing things, and I wasn't happy about all the stuff. And then I remember, you know, I got a call to go to the Department of State, and I was happy to do that. And that turned out to be the best thing for me because I had just a wonderful time over there and learned a lot. And that was my first, I was deputy press secretary there and corrections and executive assistant, which was cool. But then I went over and got to have my own press office as press secretary, and I was happy about that.
Right.
But you know what? It's something that I will never forget, and it's what I call, it was, even going in, I thought, oh no, you know, prisons, I know nothing about it. Well, I learned a ton. And I learned a lot working, but I learned because I had to prepare to teach the history of corrections, and to learn all that I learned, I was just amazed. And it just turned out to be really a dream job for me. I got to put a lot of things that I learned in school. My degree was in it was actually in broadcast journalism and political science. So all that sort of came together there for me. And it's still, you know, high on the list of assignments that I've had to do. I learned so much. And like you said, Ken was terrific. He was really good. And I'll tell you this experience, it was interesting. I don't remember why, but I had to go over to the governor's press office. And I remember John Taylor, who was, is John still around?
Yes, he is.
Is he in the governor's office?
No, he's been retired.
Oh, I figured. But he was one of these guys, wherever, I was never really sure how to read him, but he was excellent, and he was always about excellence. And it's like, if John liked you, your stuff, you know you did good. And so he gave me the biggest compliment, and I was surprised, but he said, of course, you learned under Ken Robinson. So he had just such great, he held Ken in such high esteem, and by virtue of that, you know, he thought I was okay, and I was like, wow. Because he never would really tell you. We just happened to have that exchange.
Right.
And so it was a great, great, great experience, and I always loved talking about it, and people were always surprised. I remember going to a school, and I was talking to them about careers and what I had done, and they were like, prison? You don't look like you could do anything in prison. I thought, you know, it's not about what you look like. It doesn't matter. But it just was a wonderful time of stretching and growing and experiencing something far beyond what I ever thought I would do.
Amazing. Iris, I want to thank you for participating in this project. I really, really appreciate it.
My privilege. It's great to go back and remember these things. That was a long time ago.
It was, but
wow.
But in some cases, the memories are so vivid, almost like it was yesterday.
Oh, yeah. I can see the yard. I can see the officer down. I can see the inmates kind of circling him. Everybody's not doing it, but it's like a schoolyard fight where it starts and everybody gathers around to watch. It was that same kind of thing, and it was just, it was terrifying. Mm. And I remember, you know, like I said, I told you about the commissioner's call over to the, all over to the facility, and I initiated that. It's like, commissioner, something's going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it like it was yesterday.
Yep.
I remember that. I remember the flames and, you know, when the thing was burning and that helpless feeling and wondering if everybody's okay. And the families who were wondering about their loved ones, you know, in prison. And I believe we got a call or two at the press office, you know, my son and my daughter, whatever, and they couldn't hear from them. It was awful.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely awful. Like the Titanic going down and nobody, you can't do anything about it.
Right.
It's not that you can't do anything, but there's very little until you get to a point, you know, where you can't.
Right. Yep.
And I remember the press conference that Ken did. It was Ken, it was the commissioner, the state police commissioner, and his deputy, and they were all out on the grounds, probably near the parking lot, and they had this big press conference where all the media was there to get their questions answered. And you know, it's as tragic as it is, it was a terrific experience for us.
Mm.
It
well,
really was.
It certainly did change everything in corrections, the way we build our facilities, how we respond, the different specialty teams, all the policies on tools and all the stuff that was inside the prison that nowadays you think, wow, how was that even allowed? It just, it changed everything.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you remember what started the riot?
Well, through all these different interviews, somebody said to me that it was just an officer at the E-gate was commenting to an inmate who had been wearing the wrong shoes. And I guess that enough frustration had built up that the inmate just sucker punched him, and that started it.
That's not what I heard.
Oh, what did you hear?
It's my understanding there used to have, like, family days where families could bring, like, the favorite food.
Right.
Of the inmate, mama's pound cake, somebody's spaghetti or whatever. They could bring those things in, and it had been a tradition over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But so much contraband was coming in on that day that they stopped it.
Right.
And so the inmates were so upset, as I heard it, they were so upset. And so then there was the discussion that you start with as little as you want. You can always add things, but you can't really take things away.
Mm-hmm.
When you're locked up, these things mean so much. And so it's my understanding that was the thing that had them up in arms. Now, maybe the punch, you know, really set it off.
Mm-hmm.
But they were angry, as I understand it. They were angry because these privileges were taken away and families could no longer bring, you know, the special dish.
That is true. Yep. So that was a lot of the stuff that was kind of that led up to the punch. They were making changes in sick call. There was a lot of idle time for the inmates, especially the long-term inmates. There wasn't enough programming, parole violators. So it was just kind of like a perfect storm of all these different policy changes all happening all at once. And, you know, there we have it.
Wow. And the crazy part about Camp Hill was a holding facility. You had some people who were there, as I recall, but they were sentenced. They would go there before they were assigned to their next prison. So you had a real disparity in the kind of inmate you had.
Yeah, mostly it was a transient population. So they would come in and go, but they still had to have that kind of group that actually ran the facility, because we used the inmates to feed and to, you know, keep the facility operating and all that other stuff. So most of them were on their way to somewhere else.
Yeah. And you know, now I don't know if the law is the same, but it's like if you had 5 or more years, you went to state. If it was anywhere 2 to 5, the judge had some discretion as to whether they kept you in the county or sent you to state. So the point I was making is, you have somebody maybe with a 5-year sentence whose crime wasn't, you know, as serious as somebody who's coming in for life, or, you know, for something really bad, but you had them all together, they get tied up in a riot and maybe even get more time, you know, based on what happened. And it's like, it was just unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you, Iris. I'm going to let you go. I have another interview.
Okay, sure.